All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Bruce Castle presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Mormon. To my left is Judge Lance. We're here today in the matter of Bernardine Acevedo has a docket number of 10-3402. Counsel for the parties, please note your appearance for the record.
Good morning, Your Honors. Landon Overby from the law firm of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick, representing Ms. Acevedo, and joining me at counsel's table is Zachary Stills, also of the law firm. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Thompson. I represent the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. With me at counsel table is Deputy Assistant General Counsel John Moriarty.
Thank you very much. Are both parties ready to proceed?
We are, Your
Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present an argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of our time, if I could, please.
You may, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Ms. Acevedo asserts that the Court should vacate the decision of the Board of Veterans' Appeals because it concluded Ms. Acevedo was not entitled to service connection and compensation for a psychiatric disability to include post-traumatic stress disorder. As explained in Ms. Acevedo's opening brief, VA amended 38 CFR 3.304 in 2010 to create a liberalizing evidentiary standard for establishing an in-service stressor related to her fear of hostile military activity.
Mr. Overby, have you abandoned on appeal any argument under 3.304F5?
Your Honor, we have not raised that argument, and I would suggest that we have abandoned that since we have not made that argument.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Your Honor. The Board made a legal determination in its decision here that the amended regulation applied to Ms. Acevedo's claim. The critical thing here, though, is that the Board of Veterans Appeals did not properly apply that regulation to the evidence in the incident case. Ms. Acevedo's claim for service connection for PTSD meets all of the elements of the newly amended regulation 38 CFR 3.304F3. First, she has a diagnosis of PTSD by a VA psychologist. Second, the VA psychologist indicated that Ms. Acevedo her claimed stressors were adequate to support a diagnosis of PTSD, and that the veteran's symptoms were related to those stressors. The veteran's in-service stressors are also consistent with the types, places, and circumstances of the veteran's service, as her stressors related to her interactions with fellow soldiers and supervisors.
Explain that more.
Ms. Acevedo has alleged as her stressors that she was either sexually assaulted, seduced into relationships, sexual relationships with supervisors, other members of her unit while she was in basic training. And as a result, she developed fear, helplessness, and...
Now, is that consistent with her service?
Well, it's consistent...
Or her location?
Well, it's consistent with her service because she was assigned with her military unit.
I'm thinking of sitting in a building and some terrorist come by and places a bomb and blows the bomb up, and consistent with that, people ran out and you fall and you hurt yourself. That seems to be consistent with the events that are occurring.
Certainly, Your Honor.
So how is being in a unit and being personally assaulted consistent with being in the unit?
Because that's how VA defines it.
Where?
They define it in their final rule, and if I may read... Just to give you some insight, VA believes that the fear of hostile military or terrorist activity means that a veteran experienced, witnessed, or was confronted with an event or circumstance. The term circumstance means a condition, fact, or an event accompanying, conditioning, or determining another, an essential or inevitable concomitant. They go on to state, the rule provides that a veteran's fear need not emanate from a single event or be consistent with the veteran's MOS, but rather the fear may result from conditions to which the veteran was exposed during service.
But isn't the important phrase there, the fear of hostile military or terrorist activity is the generator for this ongoing fear?
Certainly, Your Honor. And if I can elaborate on that, she was in the military. She felt that the assaults that she suffered in the military were hostile, and she had a fear because of those. And it was as a result of the fact that she was in that unit.
So it's your position, then, that the word hostile doesn't mean an opposing force. It's just an act of hostility toward you.
It is our position, and I believe it's VA's position in the final rule. They
say so any military assault would be covered under F3?
Yes, Your Honor.
To include military sexual assault?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would any sexual assault also be covered under F5?
It could be, yes.
Why would the Secretary promulgate a regulation that has two different standards to be applied to exactly the same set of circumstances under the same discussion of PTSD?
Well, Your Honor, I think the VA has explained it well in the final rule that it 304F3 provides just another avenue. It doesn't restrict, it doesn't, and to use their actual language, it provides an avenue which veterans seeking disability compensation for PTSD can establish service connection, does not restrict or supersede any existing VA rules intended to assist claimants. And they've also indicated here that it has no geographical limitation to it.
But in terms of an explanation, in the explanation with regard to response to comments received, didn't VA specifically address this military sexual trauma issue as to whether or not it's covered in subsection F3?
They did discuss it, and they did discuss the military sexual trauma and other things, and did indicate that it's also covered by F5. But they provided no limitations as to providing a standard of using F3.
So where they said in the Federal Register, these comments concerning MST are outside the scope of this rule, that doesn't exclude MST from sub 3?
I believe it does not, no, Your Honor.
I understand
so
your position.
So isn't the operative provision that it still must be consistent with places, types, and circumstances of the Veterans Service? And I'll have to go back and focus on that for a second. Let's assume you have a military person, soldier, sailor, airman, marine, who
Coast Guard.
Yeah, had them all. who is terrorizing the female soldiers on base. And this is happening over a period of time. And there are sexual assaults that are occurring. And it turns out it's a military person.
Okay, yeah.
And during that time period, and a soldier comes up later and files a claim and talks about their problems associated with, and it's all documented, making an easier case. Perhaps that falls under 3. Falls under 5, sexual assault. Perhaps it falls under 3. Because the places, types, and circumstances of the service reflect that this environment is where she was assigned. What do you have here that supports that? I've gone through this record, I've gone through your briefing, I don't see where you show anything of a place, type, or circumstance of the veteran's service that reflects sexual assault as being the type of thing that she'd be involved in.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that if you look at the terminology, places, circumstances of the individual's type of service, Ms. Acevedo was in basic training. That was a place of her military service. It was a circumstance because she had to be there. And you have to...
There's no question she's in... but you're asking the court to make a jump that because somebody is in basic service, that the routine is they're subjected to sexual abuse, and unless you give us some information that's there in this particular unit documented, I think that's a pretty long jump.
Well, I understand your position, Your Honor, but I believe that the VA has defined that, as I just read, that the circumstances, it doesn't have to be associated with a particular MOS.
No, I'm saying accept that, whether we do or not, but accept it for purposes of this discussion that it can happen. How do you say that it happened? I mean, if you're assigned in a combat zone, your circumstances are a combat zone and certain things are accepted. If your job is dangerous to begin with, and we know it involves climbing trees or something, I don't know, you might be able to say the circumstance of falling out applied. But how does that apply here? Just because you're a female soldier in a unit, it seems like you're making an awful, asking the court or everybody to make an awful big jump.
Well, the other critical thing, though, Your Honor, about this regulation, the amended regulation, is her lay testimony won't be just accepted on its own unless it's confirmed, the stressor is confirmed by the actual VA psychologist or psychiatrist.
Well, actually, the stressor doesn't have to be confirmed by them. That determination is still made by the board. The stressor would only be, if a doctor said that stressor can be the cause of her PTSD and she has PTSD, that's the corroborating evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so then the board doesn't even have to accept that. It's just corroborating evidence. They still can make factual determinations. But again, I'm having a hard time how you get to places and circumstances.
Well, Your Honor, and I would have to rest on and defer to VA's interpretation when they published the final rule. They described what they felt to be fear of military or hostile military or terrorist activity.
Still has to be consistent with the place.
And they did describe that.
Well, if you find that, you can read it to me again, because I didn't see where that part of it was read, or hear where that part of it was read.
And if I can provide you with the Federal Register page number, I'd be more than happy to do so.
I've got it here.
Okay.
Or I don't know if it's going to be the same page numbers, but you can certainly refer me to it.
From the Federal Register, it would be 39844. This would be from the July 13, 2010.
What's the paragraph begin with?
Paragraph begins, VA believes,
mm-hmm.
in the first column,
mm-hmm.
second full paragraph.
And keep reading down. In addition, consistent with that section, VA regulations provide consistently with places, types, and circumstances. Is shown by the service records, official history of the organization, medical records, pertinent medicals, and lay evidence. So I think it's undercutting what you're trying to suggest.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that one aspect of what you just read is the lay evidence. The circumstances of her service were that she was sexually assaulted. At the place of where that occurred was in the military. It can't be such a... I don't believe that it can be read so narrowly. I think that's why they explained it up above, that it doesn't have to be in relation to a particular MOS or a single event. It could be the entire conditions of a veteran service, according to VA's language. The entire conditions, Mrs. Acevedo's incidents primarily occurred in basic training.
But here, that's like suggesting that a soldier comes in and says, I was in combat. And all the records say that he wasn't in combat. So what? He says he was in combat.
Well, VA would be able to show by clear and convincing evidence that the veteran was not in combat.
Do you think it would take clear and convincing evidence to show that he was not in combat if all you had was a statement that he was in combat?
Well, VA, that they put that in their regulation. It says clear and convincing evidence to the contrary.
That he was in combat or not in combat?
Not in combat. So if they could turn around... Similar
I thought if he was in combat, you had to accept what he said as long as it was consistent with the circumstances, unless there was clear and convincing evidence that what he said didn't occur. That's a little different than saying he was or was not in combat. Isn't the determination of whether he was in combat or not just a regular preponderance of the evidence?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that's in the regulation, F3, where it says, unless clear and convincing evidence to the contrary.
You want to look at F3?
Certainly, Your Honor.
If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I don't mind.
It would be in the first sentence, Your Honor.
Read it.
It says, in the absence of clear and convincing evidence to the contrary, or did you want me to read the entire?
Well, is this F3, first sentence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe I got a different read. Mine says, if a stressor claimed by a veteran is related
to the veteran's fear of hostile military terrorist activity. And it goes on to say to be a psychiatrist or psychologist.
Right, but that's the stressor itself. That's what I was saying. If the event, the occurrence, the stressor alleged by the veteran, if it occurred in combat, needs to be accepted unless there's clear evidence to the contrary. But the determination of combat isn't itself a determination made on clear evidence. It's a preponderance of the evidence.
No, but I understand that. But I'm just talking to what the language of the regulation states, that if VA comes in with clear and convincing evidence that the veteran was not in combat, just because of the mere fact they determine, a veteran alleges that, for example, I was in combat in Vietnam, yet service records clearly show that the veteran was not out of the country at any time during his military service.
I have your position. You think that would require clear evidence.
But we believe that the evidence does establish that she meets all the elements. She meets the requirement that she had a fear of hostile military activity due to the circumstances of her service that resulted in a response that involved horror, helplessness, or fear. And
with regard to that, there was some discussion in the Federal Register of people that made arguments that perhaps it violated equal protection to provide this lenient rule to some and not others. But you have not made that argument, is that correct?
I'm not sure I follow your question. Which
in the Federal Register, there was some discussion as to whether or not this lenient rule applied to a select group of veterans under certain circumstances created an unequal situation violating equal protection, because other veterans wouldn't be covered by it. If we were to hold, for example, that you had to be in a hostile terrorist situation under the circumstances within the that you served in, and that that was one category, and an individual sexual assault, not having circumstances where that was occurring throughout the unit, was a separate category. There was a discussion in the Federal Register about equal protection. But I don't see where you've made that argument at all.
We have not made that argument.
Just wanted to be clear.
You've talked a little bit about what the VA said in its final rule promulgation in response to comments. am I to take it that you also concede that the regulation itself is not clear on its face as including the appellant?
I think the regulation is clear on its face that it applies to the appellant because of the fact that she experienced a fear of hostile military activity. If there's any sort of ambiguity as to the regulation, we can look to VA's own language in the final rule, and that just supports our argument.
Mr. Overby, you know what a barracks blanket party is?
I'm sorry?
You know what a barracks blanket party is?
I'm familiar with it, yes, Your Honor.
All right. So let's assume that I was a young troop in basic training, kept messing up and being responsible for my squads losing its privileges to go off post, passes, and so forth. They put a blanket over me at night and beat me up. That's a barracks blanket
party. They're familiar with it.
Yeah, all right. Okay. So, under your theory, I would be covered both under F3 and F5. Is that right?
Whichever avenue entitles you to the compensation. It's similar to, I look at it as being akin to 38 CFR 3.303. If there is, you can establish direct service connection under subsection A. You can establish service connection based on continuity of symptomatology, chronicity, or under subsection C, you have a different method of establishing service connection. So it's the same thing with 38 CFR 3.304F, is that it provides multiple avenues, as I just indicated a little bit earlier, according to VA's language.
Multiple avenues with two different standards of proof.
I believe so, Your Honor.
So then F5 is basically superfluous.
I don't believe it's superfluous. I believe that VA, if they wanted to, they could have eliminated it, but they also stated in their final rule, whenever they published in the Federal Register, that it doesn't supersede or doesn't restrict anything. They're all available avenues in which to establish service connection. I think if I was a shellback or a polywog and trying to go through the shellback ritual, that would fall under either F3 or F5. If it resulted in fear of hostile military activity.
Just to expand on the example, if you had a military commander who sanctioned that situation, and it occurred throughout the unit for a good year or 2 years, and it was documented that it occurred throughout the unit for a year or 2 years through the investigation that occurred later on when this finally got raised, and a soldier came forward and said they were subjected to that type of beating, you might have circumstances in the unit to which this person was assigned that might fall under three. I'm not saying it does or doesn't, but the argument seems to me that's a difference than the individual situation. It goes back to what I was trying to get you to explain here. What circumstances of an assignment to that unit would lead one to say that this soldier's accusation of sexual assault was consistent with their assignment?
Your Honor, looking at my scenario, if a veteran claimed that I went through the showback ritual,
okay,
that if clear and convincing evidence to the contrary, if VA can show that the veteran was never on the ship, we can establish she went to basic training, so she was in a particular place. She has provided her circumstances, which have been alluded to in the briefs as well in the record, and she had the fear.
Okay.
That qualifies under the regulation.
You're running sorely low. Would you add 3 minutes, please? Because we had two other areas, as I recall. One was a reasons and basis associated with the board's decision not to apply this rule, implicit, not explicit. And then you also alleged an inadequate medical exam.
That is correct.
I'd like to ask a question on that. With regard to that, the inadequacy, I understand, is the medical doctor's discussion of why he did not believe depression was service-connected. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So it's not an inadequacy with regard to the PTSD discussion.
In the briefs, I will admit, it was limited to the major depression.
All right.
But the evidence does establish that she has the requisite diagnosis from
Is it your belief that if you have depression coming 10 or 15 years after service, that somehow it can be connected to service if you had an indication of some depression in service?
Certainly. I think the regulations, the ones that I mentioned, not 304, but
even though there's a lack of continuity of any depression between that time period?
If there's a lack of continuity, then yes. Nothing in there that would establish, but she has talked about how she has felt over the years. I believe that establishes her continuity of what she's experienced, whether it's attributable to the PTSD or the depression,
certainly PTSD could pop up and be tied to something in service.
Certainly, but she still has had these problems since she came out of military service.
Right, but you do agree that depression is a little bit different. You can't just pop up and be tied back.
It is different, but she did have problems during her military service as well. She was hospitalized, actually, for a suicide.
Was she ever diagnosed for depression while in service?
She was diagnosed, if I'm not mistaken, with adjustment disorder, right, as a result of the suicidal attempt.
Wasn't that described as a gesture rather than an attempt?
Gesture,
I'm just asking for accuracy.
I think it was described as a gesture, but she did take an overdose of medications.
Atarax or something.
That is correct. I look at it as a suicidal attempt. But if there are no further questions?
I have a couple.
Certainly.
I have to circle back a little bit here.
Go ahead and add 2 minutes on.
With regard to the interpretation of 3.304 F3.
Yes, Your Honor.
In the notice of proposed rulemaking, there is a lengthy discussion Federal Register 42617 and thereafter. Concerning fear of hostile military or terrorist activity, and then it says We view this to mean the veteran experienced witnessed or was confronted with an event or circumstances involving actual or threatened death or serious injury or threat physical integrity, such as the potential improvised explosive device, vehicle embedded explosive device, incoming artillery, rocket or mortar fire, grenade, small arms fire, suspected sniper fire, etc., etc., etc. Nowhere in any of that is there any description of anything that I see that would indicate an assault, sexual or otherwise. Can you point me to something in this description laid out in the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking that would embrace the circumstances that we're looking at here?
Not in what you just read, Your Honor, but I will say that in the final rule, VA came out and specifically said, VA, because several commenters talked about the list and only being related to those things previously listed in the NPRM, but they said VA intends to present a list of examples to illustrate what qualifies in the event or circumstance, not a defining restriction.
Please add another 2 minutes.
And that would be at the Federal Register 39844, volume 75, in the column 2. And because a lot of the comments that dealt with this were focused on, does it have to be just with the enemy? And VA explained here that it could be with others, it could be civilians, it could be, there is no geographical limit. It applies to all sailors. They say that up front in the final rule.
But isn't that all contextually? Don't we have to look at the context? And isn't it all contextually the fact that there are no longer forward lines of battle? There are no longer forward line of troops. The enemy is everywhere. The enemy can be anywhere. And this takes notice of the fact that you can be in a hostile environment in a military sense anywhere in the world. Isn't that what the regulation is really aimed at?
I think it's aimed at fear of hostile military or terrorist activity. If I'm on active duty walking down the street in Washington, D.C., there's always that fear of a possible terrorist attack. But F3 is a very liberalizing standard. VA said that specifically, and they didn't provide any limitations on it, according to their final rule.
Well, it said that it was geographically unlimited, but it also said contextually you have to look at the circumstances in which the soldier, sailor, airman, marine finds him or herself.
Correct, Your Honor, and I'm not sure if Chief Judge Castle believes me what I explained.
I think, would you like to add 2 more minutes?
I'm just additional? About done.
Yeah, okay, add another minute, please. Are we going to subtract this from his rebuttal time? No. This is Judge's question.
Go ahead.
I just think you have to look at the circumstances and the broad picture of how they define this, why they came up with this thing. And it wasn't an exclusive, or it wasn't a limited list of examples. I realize it's coming out, and probably because VA had a lot of pressure from Congress because of what was going on, lawsuits around the country, but still, there's a broader sense here that they're making a liberalized standard, so long as it's consistent with the types of places and circumstances I explained to Chief Judge Castle, as we believe, there was a fear of hostile military activity. In Ms. Acevedo's case, her fear was her fellow soldiers because she was assaulted, in her opinion.
Okay, let me ask you this, with the final question. With regard to the way that the board disposed of her claim, they disposed of it on the basis that they found, by a preponderance of the evidence, that there was no current diagnosis of PTSD. What is the error in their determination that there was no PTSD? They weighed the varying diagnoses. I recognize that there's evidence in here at least twice of a diagnosis of PTSD. There's also evidence of a diagnosis of no PTSD. Isn't that the board's province?
It is the board's province, but there are several problems, and I see that my time is up. I don't
answer the question.
Certainly. Thank you. First and foremost, the preponderance of the evidence. The examiner from 2001 rendered a diagnosis based on her alleged assaults. The VA Vet Center psychologist also rendered a diagnosis based on her descriptions. Therefore, she's had two diagnoses. I know this is not merely a weighing game, but the first one definitely took into consideration the fear of hopelessness, horror, and rendered the diagnosis. But even if you look at the current 2008, from November 2008, the non-diagnosis, we've argued the examination is adequate. We believe that the examination is not in comport with the current regulation because of the fact that she had a fear of hostile military activity. And to be honest with you, the opinion is ambiguous because it says it does not appear that she had a traumatic thing in the sense of the PTSD criteria. But it also says that she was victimized. So the opinion, to be honest with you, it is all over the place in our belief.
Any further questions?
No, he's up.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
If you need additional time, we'll get to you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Brian Thompson, and I represent the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. With me at counsel's table is Deputy Assistant General Counsel John Moriarty. The Secretary respectfully submits that the plain language and regulatory history of 38 CFR 3.304F3 make clear that the regulatory provisions addressing fear of hostile military or terrorist activity are irrelevant to the determination of whether PTSD based on alleged stressor of in-service assault is connected to service. As argued in his brief, it is the Secretary's position that the regulatory provisions addressing PTSD based on an alleged stressor of assault contained in at subsection F5 of the same regulation are the only PTSD regulations relevant to a
claim. Why would you say that? What excludes 3 from applying to the appropriate situation?
Your Honor, as...
I mean, hostile activity, terrorist activity does not have to include a foreign enemy. Correct?
True.
The veteran's experienced, witnessed, or is confronted with an event involving actual or threatened death, serious injury, threat to physical integrity of even civilians, an event could qualify as a stressor. So why would you exclude across the board, or what reading excludes across the board, F3 from applying to a situation where a soldier was raped if the rest of the criteria were met?
Your Honor, the Secretary, as argued in the Secretary's brief, the first basis for reaching that conclusion is the language of the relevant regulatory provisions. F3 does not use the language of personal assault. It uses language of fear of hostile military or terrorist activity. While F5 uses exclusively the language personal assault, in-service personal assault, excuse me, without using fear of hostile military or terrorist activity. The Secretary believes that alone is sufficient to demonstrate that different circumstances, different stressors were intended. However, to the degree that there's ambiguity or that the hypothetical...
Who defines a terrorist activity?
That would be a...
If I'm sitting in a chair and somebody's got a knife to my neck, or a female's and somebody wants to rape them, it sure seems like a terrorist activity to me.
Your Honor,
so did somebody define terrorist activity to be what?
Is there
a definition of terrorist activity here?
Not in this regulation.
So you're just proposing your view of a terrorist activity, that what, it's got to be the Taliban or somebody like that?
No, Your Honor. Okay. I apologize. I was not...
I guess I'm trying to figure out why you would exclude an assault from terrorist activity.
The Secretary's position is that, as I stated earlier, the language, in addition to the language.
But the language...
That's not the only basis. Yeah,
excuse me. No, go ahead. If you can say
so,
you,
so, just to be clear, the Secretary's position is that F3 and F5 are mutually exclusive.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's take the Fort Hood situation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Person in uniform stands on a platform and starts shooting fellow soldiers. F3 or F5?
Your Honor, obviously the inquiry would be fact-specific, and VA might develop initially under both theories before determining which is applicable. But the adjudication would be under F3 or F5.
But they're not mutually exclusive then?
I apologize, Your Honor. They are exclusive in application. But initially,
just to be clear, I want to make sure I get this. I agree with you. I can use F3 and I have to use the criteria of F3.
Okay.
Or I can use F5 and I have to use the criteria of F5. And to that extent, I agree. It's exclusive. But if I used F5 and I didn't get it, and the situation just mentioned by Judge Mormon was being reviewed by the Secretary and came under it, which I thought you were implying it might, I could then use F3 and you might get an award. I mean, they're only mutually exclusive in the fact that the criteria in each are mutually exclusive. But you might fall under both, wouldn't you, in the example given by Judge Mormon?
It's the Secretary's position that the Federal Register notice, to which I believe Judge Mormon referred, saying that F5 was outside of the scope, makes clear that F3 and F5 are intended to address different situations.
But let's take the sexual element out of it for a minute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If the same person who was the shooter at Fort Hood,
yes, Your Honor,
was in a group of soldiers and he punched one of them in the mouth, okay, is that F3 or is that F5?
Obviously, Your Honor, that's a different factual situation than we have here. In attempting to address that situation, that would appear to be under F5 as you have described it.
What if he yells some religious threat when he punches the fellow soldier? Does that move it to F3?
Your Honor, respectfully, going to Chief Judge Castle's earlier point, it must be, in order to qualify for F3, in addition to the fear of hostile military terrorist activity, which you're, I think, attempting to explore, it must also satisfy the regulation in terms of being consistent with the place, type, and circumstances of service.
Okay, let's say that in a tent in Iraq, a disgruntled American Muslim soldier lobs a grenade into a tent and wounds and kills fellow soldiers. Is that an F3 or an F5?
Your Honor, the grenade would seem to place it closer to F3, if not explicitly in F3, although, again, there is the consistent with the places and types of service. It also may well meet the definition of F2 for combat, Your Honor. That was one note in your discussion with opposing counsel. Some of the circumstances you were describing truly appear to be addressed by F2, not F3. It's fear of hostile military or terrorist activity, such as the non-inclusive, you know, list in the regulation. IEDs were mentioned, explosive devices on cars. That fear is of those type of activities which do not meet the definition of combat, according to DA's definition of combat, and also according to the study by the National Academy, I apologize, Your Honor, it's the IOM study that's referred to in the Federal Register notice. DA relied heavily on that study, which stated that in the modern battlefield, there are no finite lines. The threat of attack is constant, and that stressful environment.
So the Taliban comes over, sets up an IED on Fort Belvoir, it explodes, people are injured, is that a terrorist activity?
It sounds like it certainly could
be. Okay. Sergeant X of the United States Marine Corps takes a IUD, sets it up, and it explodes on Fort Belvoir. Is that a terrorist activity?
It sounds like it may be.
Okay. So it could also be an assault.
Your Honor, certainly there are many things that occur in combat. Yeah,
so it doesn't sound like they're mutually exclusive. All right.
Let's take the Chief's example one step further. The Marine goes to Fort Belvoir and instead of using an IED, shoots somebody. Does a weapon of choice make a difference between 3 and 5?
Your Honor,
or punches somebody.
I apologize.
No, I apologize. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Your Honor, in F3, multiple different weapons are described. A grenade is an example. I believe small arms fire or even mortar fire is described as well. In F5, weapon is not described. So the Secretary's position is not that the weapon of choice, to use your phrasing, distinguishes between F3 and F5. The Secretary's position is that he has defined in the regulation itself and in the Federal Register notice that what falls into F5, personal assault, including sexual assault, is not in F3. So whatever hostile military and terrorist activity is, whatever rises to that level, it is not under F5. It is not personal assault. That is the Secretary's position, and the Secretary respectfully submits that that position is clear in the language of the regulation, and that it is again clear in the Federal Register notice. And by the language of the regulation, it is the exclusive use of the term fear of hostile military or terrorist activity in F3 and exclusive use of the term in-service personal assault in subsection F5. Certainly, there are other examples or other ways in which F3 and F5 are distinct in the Secretary's view. Chief Judge Castle, you noted the sort of frequency with which a rape or other assault would have to occur before being so consistent with the place of service. In the Federal Register notice, it was noted, I believe in 75 FR, the response to comments, that an analogy was made to PTSD based on combat or on prisoner of war status. And it was noted that in the modern battlefield, like in combat and like in prisoner of war situations, it is undisputed that the veteran who served in combat or served in prisoner of war or was a prisoner of war was exposed to that type of threat. And so the Secretary also submits that something like rape or assault by fellow service members, or even, frankly, assault from an Iraqi national, is not so consistent with any service in any overseas or domestic deployment that it reaches the level of F3. And now, as stated, that is not, you know, the Secretary's basis or exclusive basis, but it certainly is another way of distinguishing between what is covered by F5 and what is covered by F3. Additionally, as I began to say earlier, the IOM study details the types of stressors which were intended to be covered. IEDs and explosive devices on vehicles, sometimes small arms fire, attack on friendly aircraft, those type of things. Those represent a continuum. All of those things are similar in that they are events that could happen that do not rise to the level of combat, but they are things that hostile military terrorist activity have done repeatedly in the most recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. However, nowhere have personal assaults or rapes been perpetrated on the American soldier in deployment so consistently that it would rise to be to the level of being undisputed that every veteran that served in that place or that time was exposed to that type of behavior. The Secretary respectfully submits, therefore, that obviously we believe that the language of the regulation indicates the intent. Further, the Federal Register notice answers any question as if the language was ambiguous. If there was ambiguity in the language, the Federal Register notice answers that question and specifically says assault is outside the scope of F3. However, if the court does not accept that as the Secretary's position, and the Secretary would respectfully submit that it is entitled to deference, there are other differences between any assault or sexual assault in service and the situations, the types of attacks that are identified in F3.
Where does it say assault is outside the scope?
Your Honor, it is at 75 FR 39845. The paragraph reads, it's titled Coverage of Other Stressors. Would you like me to read it, Your Honor?
Just a second.
Well, the Chief's reading, let me slip in a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
If the board correctly weighed the evidence, or if the board weighed the evidence and we treat their weighing with deference under our standard of review and concluded that PTSD was not shown, is that the end of the matter?
Your Honor, the lack of a diagnosis certainly precludes the finding of benefits based on a disability.
At least under 3.304.
Yes, Your Honor. Right. Yes, Your Honor. Opposing counsel appears to have made a challenge to the application of the regulation. It is difficult for me to understand what prejudice resulted, but perhaps that's an issue that is better addressed by opposing counsel.
Let me ask you one other question, and I'm sure the Chief has some questions. And that is, we've spent a good amount of time here discussing what was covered and what wasn't covered and why it was covered and why it wouldn't be covered, et cetera, and throwing around examples and analyses. And I don't see any of that in the board decision with regard to F3. Is that a reasons or basis failure?
Your Honor, respectfully, and I believe this was in the Secretary's brief as well, the board is only required to address regulations which are potentially applicable. The board also didn't discuss the applicability of subsection F2 relating to combat or subsection F4 relating to prisoner of war status. The Secretary respectfully submits that, as previously stated, the regulation on its face and the Federal Register notice make clear that F3 was not intended to apply to assault cases. The only claim stressor by appellant has ever put forward is an assault during service.
But the board did lay out the change to the regulation and lay out F3.
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet it didn't discuss it.
Well, it noted, which was relevant for its discussion, which version of the Federal Register, or I'm sorry, not the Federal Register, the regulation applied. And that was relevant insofar as whether or not the assault provisions were contained at F5 or previously at F4 under the older versions of the regulations. So the Secretary respectfully submits that the Board was certainly aware of F3 and did not discuss it beyond noting the change in regulation because it was not relevant to this claim, as appellant has only ever alleged assault during her basic training.
Anything additional?
Thank you. Your Honors, Secretary respectfully requests that the Court affirm the Board decision and find that subsection F3 is irrelevant to a claim for entitlement to benefits based on PTSD when the alleged stressor is in-service assault. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Overby, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just wanted to come back to, I think it's Judge Mormon's and your question, Chief Judge Castle, pertaining to the circumstances, the time, place, and circumstances, and the definition of fear of hostile military activity. I know I've read quite a bit from the final rule, which I believe BA has done an adequate job of explaining what they mean. But they define the definition of fear of hostile military terrorist activity is not limited to any particular class of individuals. The involvement is actual or threatened death or serious injury or threat to the physical integrity of the veteran or others, which is not limited to military personnel, is all that is required to qualify as an event or circumstance. And that's from 39844 of the final rule. But then on 39845, they go on to say the rule is intended to apply only when the veteran's service is proximate in time and place to the traumatic event to which the veteran has responded with intense fear, helplessness, or horror. So in that regard, Ms. Acevedo, the proximate in time and place was the fact that she was there in basic training. It was the time that she was assaulted, and that was the circumstance of that time and place. And that, I think that, in my opinion, answers about the circumstances, the time, the place, and she suffered the helplessness, fear, or horror. But as to the fear of hostile military activity, it defines that person's response to it.
Let's concentrate on the opening phrase there, though, Mr. Overby. And the opening phrase of what you just quoted is consistent with these findings. And then the prior sentence says the IOM committee defined deployment-related stress as deployment to a war zone and considered the military personnel deployed to a war zone, even in direct combat, was not experienced, have the potential for exposure to deployment-related stressors that might elicit a stress response. Isn't the context there the kind of military hostility that VA is arguing was meant to be captured in sub 3 rather than personal or sexual assault in a non-hostile environment in a traditional military definition of hostile environment sense?
I don't believe so. I believe that what they're referencing is the IOM study, but they say this rule is intended to do this. And I realize it says consistent with the findings, but they say elsewhere that F3 is just another avenue for, if for example, a veteran was a POW, certainly could rely on F4 or F3. Whichever one is gets him the benefit or her the benefit, whoever it may be. But in the beginning, they say there's no geographical limitation that applies to all sailors, and I think I've gone over it enough and beat that drum that it's not a limitation. They specifically, as you noted with opposing counsel, it's an example, a list of examples, and as the court noted in Mowerhan, such as, and the VA recognizes that in their final rule, that it's not a limitation. And F3 would qualify.
So what does the paragraph that your opposing counsel read or referred us to, coverage of other stressors, mean? Should we just ignore it?
I don't think you have to ignore it. I don't think it really says anything, except that they're not going to respond to the comments. That's all it says. the scope of the comments related to that. I don't know what the comments actually state, so I don't know what they contain.
Outside the scope of this rule?
The rule is adding another. They're not asking to amend. If they were amending F5.
You don't think the fair reading of that is that the hostile military or terrorist event is the scope of the rule?
I think it is the scope of the rule.
A military sexual trauma, abuse by military personnel, subordinate personnel, harassment and so forth are not terrorist activities or hostile?
I don't think that what the commenters, I don't know what the commenters were stating, they may have been trying to amend F5. Just like some other commenters talked about 4.125A, and they said it's not the scope of the rule, but it deals with PTSD in some fashion or another.
Well, in that paragraph, though, to be fair, Mr. Overby, that paragraph starts out by saying VA has received comments suggesting that the rule should cover stressors such as MST, abuse by military personnel or subordinate military personnel, etc. And then it says these comments are outside the scope of this rule. So we're talking about 3.304F3, clearly. And I, frankly, am having a very difficult time trying to figure out how this rule, with the explanations that VA has provided, gets you to a point where the veteran who experiences military sexual trauma or some other personal assault, outside the context of this hostile threat in a traditional military sense environment, gets a choice of F5 or F3. I just am having a hard time getting there. So if you would please focus on that paragraph and explain why we must read that as something other than a clear statement by the Secretary that military sexual trauma is not covered by this rule.
Well, if that's the case, Your Honor, that this is a clear statement, then everything else in the Federal Register for the final rule is inconsistent with what they just state here, because they're saying that there's multiple avenues to get there under F3, F2, F1, F4, F5. They say it applies to everyone, so they're all over the Richter here when it comes to limited in this passage. And I believe that if the Secretary has asked for deference of their regulation, it's clearly inconsistent in their final rule explanation. If anything, the veteran is entitled to the benefit of the doubt on the interpretation of the regulation. The Secretary had his chance to explain it, and I don't believe he's adequately explained it. It's clearly inconsistent, if anything. Now, again, turning back to the Board of Veterans' Appeals decision, they said it applied. They just didn't discuss it. They made that determination, that legal determination, that the new regulation applied. It's just a matter that they didn't discuss it, as we explained earlier, as well as in our briefs. There are no further questions.
Nothing further here.
We would ask that the court vacate the board's decision for the reasons that we've argued today as well as in our briefs. Thank you, Your Honors, very much.
Thank you very much. The court will come down and greet counsel. The case will be submitted.